yourself.
Yeah, please do.
Okay.
We have about half an hour, and I think what we might do is have 15 minutes of conversation here, and then open it up for discussion, because I'm sure people will have things to say about the film. Did you want to comment on the film, Momotada, or should we just open it up?
Kitaka should comment first, yeah.
Or I can... Yeah?
A couple of very quick points, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Well, first of all, I have to congratulate the makers of this film. I don't know if they're in the audience.
They're not here, yeah, no.
For a really powerful and moving and a very well-designed film. Films, of course, always need a narrative, and there is a narrative here, which is centered around Churchill and his complicity or his role in the making of this famine. To me, what seems really striking about the Bengal famine, and speaking as a historian, is how many people have researched this episode, of which we saw a very small subset being interviewed here. I mean, the list of names is really, really long, and of people who have written books, written book chapters, written journal articles using evidence, look for new evidence. That, of course, includes Professor Sen, but before him and after him, there's a long train of scholars, including some of the big names in famine history.
And they're not all Bengali?
No, some are, but
because
but
the
many,
ones,
many
most
are
of
not.
Them here were. Yeah,
but you do not have so many people studying what happened in 1 year in one region in 20th century world history.
Mm.
Without there being several stories, not just one story. We heard one story, but to me, this scholarship, this literature is so big and so diverse because it cannot agree on some of the basic facts of what happened. And there is a sense here, and I agree with that sense, that there were a series of actions which could count as crime against humanity. But who undertook them? Who took them, and with what degree of responsibility is very open to debate. The three most responsible actors were the Bengal government. I mean, there is a kind of slightly loose way that we hear about the British government here in this film. The British didn't rule Bengal. There was an elected government which was ruling Bengal. It was a Muslim League government. Headed by Khwaja Nazimuddin, and the most powerful minister was the food minister, Hussein Surawardi. And their role has been explored in many research, which we have heard nothing about in this film. The other actors are War Cabinet. Churchill has figured very prominently here. I don't understand why, because Churchill's private views didn't really matter to the War Cabinet as much as we might believe. It was a coalition government in the first place. Churchill had to work very carefully around the War Cabinet. The third villain in the piece is food market, grain merchants. What role did they play? I think the literature has identified these three actors who had a potential role in making the famine, but the evidence is not enough to hold any one of them decisively culpable.
Okay. I mean, of the events that took place, so that the Japanese invasion, the tsunami, those are not obviously disputed. Presumably.
Not at all, no.
So it's the redistribution, it's the politics of redistribution from places of plenty to places of scarcity. That is what is really being discussed by these various historians.
Well, we have to understand that whether there was a supply shortfall, whether it was a problem of absolute scarcity and import of food, or it was a problem of redistribution, hoarding, more people cornering food who do not need to, and leaving less for the others, that itself was a very disputed issue in Bengal in this time. The government actually believed that there is no shortage. Surawardi was very aggressively pushing that line, that there's no shortage. And it's all the merchants' mischief that is causing this famine. Before it really became clear that there was a famine, there was a humanitarian crisis on an enormous scale. And Surawardi's line was, the Bengal government's line was well-liked by Linlithgow, by Viceroy, by the Bengal governor, by London, Secretary of State Emery, we saw to begin with. And they all thought that this is a policing problem, until it became clear that it's far more than that.
So, do you want to disagree?
Well, I have to say something on the
Yes, board. Yes, please do. They're all waiting to hear you.
You have to give me a chance.
The floor is yours.
Well, first of all, it's a beautiful film. You can't say it's an enjoyable film because the subject is so grim. But it's beautifully done, nicely directed. There are very moving moments. I found, for example, Soumitra Chatterjee discussing his own acting in an earlier film, one of the most memorable, I would say, statement. And the famine itself is portrayed very well. The barbarity and the lack of concern of the rulers of India comes out very clearly. All these are important things to portray, and they're portrayed with good eloquence, communication, and I would say judgment. Now, Tirthankar has gone into the question whether the theory of famine behind it is correct. But there I would say that it isn't, but that it doesn't have to be. I mean, great films have been made without that. I mean, if you think, there are two great films on the Bengal famine. One was made in 1946, called Dhatika Lal. It was Khaja Ahmed Abbas who wrote it and who directed it, and it's still one of the... I mean, for me, it came out in 46. I remember seeing Dhatika Lal as one of the really grand experiences of my life. I was very young still then. I was 9 when the Bengal famine began and 10 when it ended. But was the theory entirely right? The theory was a very left-wing of the kind that I generally sympathize with, but a tradition that how a communal approach could have prevented it. Well, for want of a better word, it was a good communist film. And in the best sense, and it presented these were the early days, actually I'd say middle days, of great left-wing literature, as well as music, as well as drama, which produced IPTA, Bohography, and so on, a part of that. And Khaja Ahmed Abbas was a very talented person. But the story was how a community-based approach, basically socialism, would end it all. Now and then came Satyajit Ray's Ashwami Sanket, Distant Thunder. And that took a different approach altogether, a much more human approach. In fact, the main person on whom Satyajit Ray concentrated wasn't even the poorest. He is actually a Brahmin priest and relatively prosperous compared to that. But this is like Satyajit Ray always never saw the extreme, and even then you can show how terrible it was. Like Bhavnagar, in contrast with, for example, Salaam Bombay. There's no bad people there in Mahanagar, unlike in Salaam Bombay, where there's not a single good person, as far as one can see. And yet, terrible things happen. That's the style that Satyajit Ray had. So you have to see it as I don't know the directors, and I don't know whether there's this new style emerging. Is it a very successful film? Yes, it is. Is the theory of famine behind it correct? I think that being a bit like a schoolmaster to approach a film, and that may not be always the best way of looking at a film. I wouldn't say this, I think it's influenced by, Matsutri is a very interesting writer, it's influenced by her thinking, and that's a thinking that deserves attention, in which Churchill plays a part, and the major part indeed. Now, I think there's some difficulty. I may sound a bit like a Marxist in some way, and I've always been influenced by Marx, never quite a Marxist. But if you look at Marxist thing, one of them is the idea to convert a system into the guilt of a guy is to lose something major in history. If Churchill had been a nicer man, there would have been no Bengal famine. Could it be true? Absolutely not true. We're not discussing Churchill's moral character was terrible. He thought, there was no question he was a racist, and he hated Indians. He made the famous remark, Indians are the beastliest people in the world, next to the Germans. I said that in a lecture in Berlin, and I wasn't very popular. And I said, no, we are on the same side, that's what I said. I think it's the imperial system. Imperial system had some priorities, plus confusion. Let me discuss each of them. The imperial system would give priority to winning the war, keeping the metropolitan Britain. It wasn't the British food supply did go down, by the way, but the priorities have to go to some extent in that direction, if only because the war is being fought from Britain. If Britain gone, we don't know what the outcome of the war would have been. Churchill is a great figure in that fight. Nothing that we saw in the film can take that away. So there were arguments that can be said as to why, sitting in this bunker, he is trying to look at Britain being reasonably well supplied. Would it have helped to have had more grain in that time in India, in Bengal? The answer is yes. Not because the famine was caused by shortage of food. By the way, Rudrangshu said that exactly. Rudrangshu Mukherjee was quoted in the film. And that's one respect. The film shows a degree of versatility, which is important. And I'll come why I don't think it was really caused by the shortage of food. But any time a famine occurs, no matter why, for the government to have a stock of food is a great thing. The government could have fed a lot of people. There was no systematic feeding. People were going to Calcutta, not because of government charity, but private charity, but there wasn't very much either. But they were going there still. The government position changed only when the parliament took notice, the British parliament. The British parliament was lulled into believing that there was no famine condition in India. Maybe some people are dying and so on. And the Bengali papers were censored, and they couldn't publish things, no pictures. Some magazines, I remember my grandmother reading it to them, like Prabhati, did carry stories and stinging editorials, but no pictures. But those were not read outside the small middle class readership. The big English paper and the great English paper, The Statesman, was there. And The Statesman wasn't censored, as a British owned paper. But the argument was that Ian Stevens, as an editor, could be relied on to understand the priorities of the war and should not print pictures. And he didn't, and didn't even criticize the government's absurd statistics. That lasted until the middle of August. And then it started changing, and then suddenly we get in October a sequence of editorials by Ian Stevens blasting the government of Britain, the British government of India, and accusing it of lying, accusing it of hiding the truth. And he wrote a very interesting book. If people are interested, should read Ian Stevens. His book is called The Monsoon Morning. It's about his life. I met him much later. Mm. He became a fellow of King's. And I went to see him. I was introduced to him by Ian Foster, Morgan Foster, in fact, though he told me that he was no friend of India, by which he meant that after the war and the Pakistan, after the partition, he became a very pro-Pakistani propagandist. That's true. But what he had done to save lives was incredible at that time. So after these editorials started coming in late October, suddenly the parliament took notice. And relief began in early November, and the famine was over by late November. Now, if the government had the food in their hand, would they have done that? No. So I don't think getting the food was the issue. Getting the food wasn't the cause of the concern, as it was mentioned by Modutri, that the year before that was a bumper crop, 42. Food prices rose 100% between December 41 and December 42. How could it happen? Because as an elementary student in economics would know, the price of food depends on supply and demand. And the demand was expanding with the army, with aerodrome construction, with major activities going on. In any measure, government expenditure, money supply, with the big differences in these different schools of thought, would suggest a boom economy. It was a boom famine. Mm. Now, in terms of the availability of food, it was not a bumper crop like the preceding year, but it was still higher than 2 years before, which didn't cause any famine. This did, because the demand situation had dramatically changed. And you have to compete for food by being able to afford the price that others are paying. I think there's one bit of slight mistake. The government did not requisition and take away food. Mm. They bought food. And that was one of the problems, because the government of the British government of India had decided that discontent in Calcutta would be unacceptable, because Calcutta was important for fighting. So the whole of the Calcutta population was protected by rationing system. And food was bought from the rural areas at whatever price it would fetch, to be sold subsidized in Calcutta. Of all the people who died in the streets of Calcutta, and I've seen many of them myself, when I came to Calcutta, I lived in Shantiniketan, there were none of them were Calcutta resident. They all came from somewhere else. Calcutta was protected, but in the process of protecting Calcutta, they bought food from the rural areas, making the prices go up. That, in addition to the demand factor, was there, already playing a part. In December, the Calcutta was bombed 5 times. I happened to be in Calcutta at that time, and there was Chittagong, which I wasn't there, but in Calcutta, and there was a panic. That fed to the problem. The point that Rudrangshu mentioned, that the government in its wisdom decided that there would be no interstate traffic in food. Mm. Food prices in Bengal was 2, 3, or 4 times that in Bihar, in Orissa, in Assam. But they were not allowed to come into Bengal. That would not have contributed quite a bit more than the shipping that did not come.
And is that what the destruction of boats and...
No, that's a different thing.
So what was that about?
Boats destruction was that I think they said, but I think they didn't put it exactly right. There was a theory that the Japanese will arrive, take the boat, and go into the countryside, which they had done in Malaya. Hmm. And what they did was to say there's a bit of Kafka in that. Because everyone was told that if you have a boat that can carry more than 10 persons, You have to bring it to something called, and this is where Kafka begins, the reception center. And if you took your boat to the reception center, they sunk it for you. Without compensation. You came with a boat and you went away without a boat, without any money in your pocket. It disrupted the river transport and disrupted fishing. Among the groups of people, I did a study in my book, if you look at the different groups, the highest group were rural, landless laborers. Then there came the fishermen and the river transport people, and they were affected. Mm. So there were many different things going wrong. So in that story, not getting these food into Bengal from the shipping played a part. Mm. It's not the central part of the story.
Mm. But Amartya, in 42, the harvest was destroyed.
But there was about a 12% reduction in crop. And that's nothing in comparison with the totality of the crop. And even after taking that into account, Matusi doesn't accept this question. He got some, he quotes there two persons who wrote, I think, unpublished thesis in America, saying that my figures are wrong because some rice station had indicated that there was a decline in those stations, and then multiplying it for Bengal, it would have been a big thing, but those were figures for those rice stations. But anyway, that's a different kind of debate. So I think there were so many things that were going wrong. The policy of not allowing interstate trade is one of them. The policy of recruiting rice at any price from rural areas without worrying what would happen to the rural population was one of them. To have rationing system in Calcutta but not anywhere else in the rest of Bengal is one of them, not even in Dhaka. And not understanding that even though their food statistics might be basically right, that doesn't tell you anything about famine because there is demand in addition to supply. And it's very sad for an economist to have to say that, you know, there's demand and supply. It sounds like a caricature of the first year class that you begin to talk about that. So it went wrong. But underlying that, and this is where the film is, right, there is a basic lack of sympathy on the part of the imperial rulers of India. Mm. And that included Churchill, it included Linlithgow appearing. Linlithgow was an extraordinarily unsympathetic figure, never went into the Bengal area. He was criticized by his successor, Wavell, who was the next viceroy. In fact, the first night when he arrived, he wonders in his notes, why is it that Linlithgow didn't manage to go to Bengal? He goes there next day. And so there was a lot of sympathy, and then he would write later also to the government, not because he converted himself, unlike Ian Stevens, but he said that the way the Her Majesty's government treats the affairs of Indians is shocking to me. Mm. So there was this complex story happening, and basic lack of sympathy and racism, did it play a part? It clearly did play a part. If I may make one final point, even when the food supply is down, if you had a good rationing system, you could manage it quite well. Britain had almost a 20% lowering of food supply during the war, Second World War. Mm. And in the same period, and this is LSE research done by Titmuss, Hammond, and others, that in the same period, cases of undernourishment dramatically fell, and cases of severe undernourishment completely disappeared from Britain. How come? When the food supply has fallen. Because everyone was being covered at a cheap price, controlled price, with rationing. Yeah. People who in a free market have never been able to get enough food for the first time was getting it. So that at the time when the food supply was down, the food problem was being resolved.
Yeah.
So I think it's complicated. Yes. The economics of it's complicated. But you know, I don't think one should judge this film by the economics of it. One should judge it as an experience. And you say, it's a very moving experience. Mm. And I certainly thought that the directors deserve credit and wait for that.
Thank you. That was Famine 101. I think we've really understood something there, I think, in both your comments. And I think at the end of the day, this is a time in LSE when this research is being done, as you write about in your Ethics and Economics, that this is an age of political economy when you talk about the politics of redistribution. These are governance issues, right, that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Racism comes into it as a political issue of what one should do in this kind of crisis. We don't actually have a lot of time, but if somebody is burning to ask questions, I'll take a couple, and then I'll just take, yeah. The gentleman in the back. Just please wait for the microphone.
That's just my stick.
Just as though it wasn't you.
No.
Yeah, but I think the microphone is lacking in there.
Yeah, no, there
it is. First of all, the film was amazingly fair, and the speakers were inordinately fair. But I think this may sound an unhistorical view, though others may think it's a very historical view. The case against the British government is proved by Grenfell House and the treatment of people in the Windrush scandal.
Mm. Can you pass it down? There's a lady in the middle of the same row.
Professor Sen, it's great to see you at the LSE again.
Loudly, I'm a very elderly man.
In your seminal work on famine, you once wrote that, if I recall correctly, that famine never happens in a democracy. Do you still hold that as true, and what do you think generally about the state of democracy and food poverty now?
Can I just take another question? We'll remember that. And just this gentleman on the same row, just pass it down. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's about lack of historical balance in British film and television. If you watch the History Channel, there's 1 million documentaries about World War II, yet you will rarely ever, well, maybe never, watch anything about a Bengal famine. There's very little historical balance. People celebrate, as the film points out, sit next to Churchill and celebrate him as the greatest Brit of all times. So what is it that we should all be doing to change that? How can we get a broader audience to watch this? How can we get this to television? Because, patriotism is becoming more exacerbated, and people are saying anything bad about Britain and Churchill can be easily dismissed as anti-patriotic. So how is it that we can spread the word?
Okay, thank you.
Why don't I answer the first question and TikToker answers the second? You get some time to think. Okay, the answer to the question, yes, indeed, I believe. And in some ways, even the main evidence for there not being a famine in a functioning democracy with free news reporting is what, on the basis of evidence from across the world, and I need not go over, how does this film relate to it? You see, India is part of a democracy, indeed the leading pioneering democracy in the world. And yet, on its governance, is not a democracy. Just the first part of the experience indicates how, when you're not a democracy and where the government could get away with false statistics, I think it's now called fake news, you can succeed in doing policies which are mistaken. India was full of economists. They knew stopping interstate trade wasn't an intelligent thing to do. They knew that in addition to supply, there is demand in determining prices. They knew that if you cannot buy food because the prices are too high, then you would have to starve. But these very simple facts, which the government was ignoring, could have been forced on them if there was a public discussion and a relatively free press, which there wasn't, and therefore there was no action taken. But India was also a part of a democracy, namely that of Britain, governed by Britain. It had a parliament. India didn't have a parliament, but Britain had. The British parliament doesn't actually discuss this issue until the statesman breaks loose. And so that's why I have to say that the only one obituary I've written in my life in the Times was because I thought that the obituary of Ian Stevens didn't mention the famine, didn't mention his role in the statesman, which seemed to me so inadequate that I was moved to write a thing on that. I came to know him well, of course. When I first went to see him, he was a fellow of King's College. I couldn't find him in his room because he was on his head. He was doing shishasana. He was doing yoga. And it had occurred to me that what looked like an implausible head was in fact his feet. And so he played a major part in changing that. And then what happened? Parliament discusses it. There is no way out for Churchill, no matter whether he's a good guy, a bad guy, a medium guy, or anyone. You have to answer that. And the result of it, of course, was that the policy changed, within the month of November, almost immediately after the statement editorial. Mm. And that prevented the famine from continuing. Of course, then came a good harvest in December. But they said the famine had broken already before that. So even within that context, by contrasting India governed on its own, India governed in addition to itself with the British Imperial Territory and the Parliament together, and free news reporting, because the statesman report was then repeated in all the papers from Manchester Guardian and the Times to Telegraph to every one of them. And so that changed the picture. So do I believe in that? Yes. Do I see support of that in the Bengal famine story? Yes. Is it in the film? No, but it need not have been. It's not about that.
Mm. Okay.
Can I? Yeah.
Please.
No, that's a very, very good point. I think the film does serve that aim of being a corrective to a mainstream historiography of the British war effort and what the War Cabinet was doing. But corrective of what? I think we have to remember that much of the British historiography around Churchill and what he was doing is about the war, not about empires. It's about the war. Now, these two things were interrelated because this is a world war, and for Churchill, not for de Gaulle, not for Roosevelt, not for Stalin, but for Churchill, having the empire, especially after Japanese, after Pearl Harbor and the Eastern Front of the war opened up, for Churchill, having this immense geographical space in control of Britain in some sense was a crucial asset. He could not afford to have any discussion on political settlement within the empire, because without that he would lose, he would be unable to fight on both fronts, the Europe, North Africa, and Pacific. None of the other major allied powers had this problem. Churchill had this problem. So for him, the war and the empire were interdependent things, and that's part of the reason why he didn't admit any discussion or any settlement, any negotiations on the future of the empire while the war was on. That was the context in which some of the very aggressive and offensive statements that came into being. And we have to put that in that context, that this was a war after all. But that's that doesn't take away the spirit of your comment, that we have this humanitarian crisis that are unfolding on the fringes of the war zone, and Bengal is not alone. In 1945, Vietnam is experiencing a massive war famine. 1942-43, Henan province in China is experiencing a famine. All of these are linked with war in some sense, but all of these are not directly under British colonial rule. So there is something going on that is very global, but not necessarily imperial or Churchill. There is another story here, and we have to, and Bengal fits into that story as well.
And India was also paying for the war, right? So this is not, I mean, there's a responsibility, but there's also, it's a revenue stream at that point.
Well, it gets repaid in sterling, yeah.
But at that point, it is important to. But I think the wider point that was being made here was also about recovering this history. And there are people in this room who, there's Ian Jack, there's Lionel Light, there are people who I think have been involved in opening up the way history is taught in schools. Basically, that's what it comes down to. And none of this nuance that Tirthankar is talking about or Amritsar is talking about is reflected in the history that's taught, that's British history. To British students in British schools is simply missing. So that's why it's such a caricature, a black and white picture that children grow up with until they get to university. This is a real
issue. I think the one thing is that since I've praised the film, and I do think it's an excellent film, I think the slight danger is to get away with the notion that it was Churchill alone who caused the famine, because that would be a very inadequate history. And it will also be a very inadequate understanding of the imperial system.
Yes. I doubt this is going to get adopted as the main text on understanding Churchill, so there's no danger of that, I don't think.
No, I don't mean as a text, but a general thing. I think one has to understand what imperialism is.
Yes, exactly.
It's not that if it happened to be some nasty people, they can make things terrible. And had there been no such nasty people, everything would have been fine.
Yeah.
The imperial system had in it inherently a trap to kill, in the sense that the attention of a huge lot of people wouldn't get the attention that a non-imperial, and coming back to the question raised, a democratic system would have.
Are people? Do you have an appetite for another 5 minutes, or would people like to leave? I think we might draw this to a close, unless there is a student.
Well, you can take one or two more questions if you want.
Well, okay, but we might start losing the audience, and I think our stewards have to go
That's
home
okay.
as well. Are there are there questions? There's a question at the back.
Is a question in front.
I know. I've seen you. I know you've had a chance yesterday, so I want to. There are new people here today, so if you don't mind. Yeah.
Thank you for an insightful discussion. My question is that while I'm sure for historical historiography and historical sort of recording purposes, it's important to look at various narratives, fact check, and then talk about the structural aspects of imperialism, which should be seen in a larger context. But I was wondering if you could talk a little more about specifically the scorched earth policy, which was used in the Bengal famine, as discussed in the film, to talk about the implications of that, which may not have been a general structural imperial setup, but specifically in the case of the Bengal famine was used to cause large-scale misery, as we saw in the film.
Okay.
Large-scale what?
Misery.
Yeah. So, but actually, did you get the main thrust of the question?
Scorched earth. I think the scorched earth policy should be.
Yeah. Well, I could respond to that, but it would depend on whether you're taking another question or not.
Okay, if you're willing, you usually don't like it, but I would like to take another question if you don't mind. So, are there any other questions at the back?
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, please wait for the microphone.
Oh, right, okay. What I want to ask, okay, I know Professor Sen said we have to see the famine in terms of the context of winning the war. Now, say, for argument's sake, I know there was a famine in Russia under Stalin during the Second World War and also in China. Now, would Western historians and people in the West, would they justify the same thing, saying that Stalin and whatever happened in China, it was justified for winning the war? I could be told about this. And also, what I want to ask Professor Sen, he said like food supply from other states were prevented from entering Bengal. Now, did people in the rest of India, other states in India, were they aware what is happening? And did the people affected by this, by the famine, were they allowed to leave Bengal for other states? I would like to know that. And also another question, just finally, the film, okay, that's all connected. Okay, that when we watched the film, it said like the state government of Bengal, who were Muslims, that they kept quiet. Did the Indian authorities and our founding fathers, Hindus and Muslims, did they keep quiet or did they collude regarding this prior to 1947? I understand
what
happened after.
Thank you. Amitra, can we ask Sitankur and then you can have the last word? Yeah, so you go.
Okay. So can I address both scorched
earth? Yes, please do.
And part of this question.
Yeah.
On the scorched earth, interestingly enough, this was